This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The next deadline on Iraq comes on Monday when the heads of the United Nations inspection teams report to the Security Council. If any emphasis was needed, Russian President Vladimir Putin said earlier today that their conclusions will be critical. In the run-up to the deadline, the Security Council is openly divided. Yesterday, France and Germany insisted that inspections be given more time. If it comes to a vote, France has hinted it might use its Security Council veto. Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder said Germany would vote no. American officials criticized their old allies and made it clear that if the Security Council fails to act, the United States may go ahead anyway. And yesterday, Prime Minister Tony Blair said that Britain would not be bound if the Security Council acted, in his word, unreasonably. The argument comes in the context of the challenge that President Bush presented to the United Nations last September.
Our Security Council resolution is to be honored and enforced or cast aside without consequence. Will the United Nations serve the purpose of its founding, or will it be irrelevant? The United States helped found the United Nations. We want the United Nations to be effective and respectful and successful. We want the resolutions of the world's most important multilateral body to be enforced.
Some say this is just a dispute over timing and perception. Others say the division goes much deeper, that we're watching the breakup of the Atlantic Alliance and a defining moment for the United Nations Security Council. What would be the effect if the U.S. and a handful of allies decide to go it alone? If the Security Council fails to act, will it be seen as spineless and irrelevant? What are the potential costs of waiting months more while inspections continue? Is it better for the Security Council to approve an unpopular war or try to block it and be ignored? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from our bureau in New York is Edward Luck. He's director of the Center on International Organization. That's located at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University in New York. Edward Luck is also the author of Mixed Messages, American Politics and International Organizations. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
We have to begin by a reminder of the structure of the Security Council. There are five permanent members, and permanent status gives you veto rights. Who are they?
They're the United States, Great Britain, France, China, and the Soviet Union, now Russia.
There are also 10 members who serve two-year terms on the Security Council. They get votes, but no vetoes. And at the moment, we're in a rotation where first France and then Germany, a member of the Security Council at the moment, will be the president of the Security Council. Does that give them any special power or authority?
Well, they can help to set the agenda. And also, there's a possibility, instead of having a resolution come out of the council that's actually voted in public, that you can have a presidential statement, which doesn't have quite the same legal authority, but is supposed to be based on a consensus in the council and might be a way out in this particular case.
Now, we're seeing a major escalation in the rhetoric between French and German officials on one side and American officials on the other over the past couple of days. What do you see behind this?
Well, I think it's partly domestic politics within Germany for sure, and probably within France as well. It's partly a real contest over American power versus European unity, and a really quite deep divide in the Atlantic between the use of force, which the U.S. tends to favor, obviously we have the capacity, and other kinds of non-forceful methods that the Europeans tend to favor, in part because they haven't kept up their military capacity.
Joining us now by his phone from his office in Hamburg, Germany, is Joseph Jaffe. He's editor of Die Zeit, a German weekly newspaper, and it's good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Hello, thank you.
I wanted to ask you the same thing. What do you read into the statements? Well, obviously, there's been some bitter rhetoric over the past couple of days.
I agree. In the German case, which we have to distinguish from the French case, the main part of the issue is, or behavior, is domestic politics, where Chancellor Schroeder learned in the summer that to oppose the United States and to oppose war was turned out to be a surefire way of winning an election where he had been behind about 5, 6, 7 points. He's now trying the same strategy because they are two very critical local, or in the U.S. we would say state elections looming on February 2. But there is the other aspect which I think is worth stressing. I think the name of the game is balance of power politics. I think the French and the Germans are trying to find ways to constrain and contain the exercise of U.S. power. So you might almost say or speculate that they seem to be more worried about the exercise of that power, which they see as excessive, than about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction.
Edward Luck, does the United States dominate the Security Council?
Not in the sense that it can in any way dictate what happens there. I think we saw in the fall 8 weeks of very tough negotiations leading up to this Resolution 1441 that authorized inspections in Iraq. The U.S. certainly was not able to dictate its terms. In the end, it got most of what it wanted, but it also had to make some very significant concessions. And I think partly because the U.S. is so powerful these days outside of the Council and outside of the U.N. walls, that somehow states like France and Germany and middle powers feel that they have to be doubly diligent within the U.N., and particularly within the Security Council, to prevent the U.S. from running away with the show. So in a sense, the more powerful we get outside, the more they try to constrain us inside.
And if you're talking about the tactics of what's been under discussion at the Council now in terms of timing and perceptions and obviously political audiences in everybody's country, not just France and Germany's, but in everybody's country, what do you think of the grander political balance of power that Joseph Joffe was talking about?
Well, I think it's very hard to build an international organization at a time when you have a tremendous asymmetry in power. When the UN was founded in 1945, there was an assumption that the five permanent members who had been allies during the wartime would try to work together, and no one of them was seen as dominant. Certainly the U.S. was the strongest on the West, and the Soviets at least had tremendous military capacity on the East, but there was no assumption that one country really was dominant. Now you're trying to make a multilateral system work in which every country in the General Assembly, at least in theory, has an equal vote. And yet the power situation in the world is very, very different. And so I think the subtext here, really, rather than being Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, again and again seems to be, what should you do about American power? And I think if our allies don't recognize that our power has to be expressed and can be expressed productively through the UN, by in fact giving the U.S. A bit more power than they recognize within the system, that in fact the U.N. is going to become less and less relevant to the realities outside in the real world.
Joseph Joffe, in the French and German view, is the United States more important to the Security Council? Does the United States need the Council more than the Council needs it?
Well, I would say that the U.N. certainly needs the United States more than the other way around, because, after all, international politics is a nasty business where, in the end, power counts for more than the nice, kind words, and that if the UN ever wants to act in the application of power against the bad guys of this world, it won't be able to act unless the United States acts with it. But I would like to add something. I think back in the post-45 situation, the United States liked the UN so much because it could truly dominate it. It meant the United States plus the West, which had the clear majority among the 45 or so member states. Now, with about 190, there have been too many and too regularly votes of the larger numbers which turned against the United States, and that of course explains why the United States is very leery, or quite leery, to go through the UN, even though George W. used some very, very patient and painstaking diplomacy for about 8 weeks to get pretty much what he wanted. And let me just add one more word. the United States can make a case and has been making a case that another resolution is not necessary, that material breach, as the key phrase has it, can trigger, quote-unquote, serious consequences. So the upshot of this is I don't think the U.S. will go back for a war resolution, and that will take the steam out of what the French and the Germans are currently planning to do.
And Edward Luck, diplomats being diplomats, generally trying to find a way to fudge their differences when push comes to shove?
I think that's quite likely, and I would be very surprised to see either France or Germany vote against a resolution that had strong U.S. support. While at the same time, I think the U.S. now has a message that it shouldn't push for a resolution that explicitly authorizes the use of force. I think if you look at a number of recent cases, including just recent weeks when the French intervened in the Ivory Coast, there is no Security Council resolution about that. When NATO and the Western countries decided to intervene in Kosovo, there was no Security Council resolution. In fact, it was known that the Soviets and Chinese would veto such a resolution, so they went by without it. And so I don't think it would be that unusual now to really fudge this, to find a way of finessing it. I can imagine a resolution that talks about the weapons of mass destruction and Iraqi unwillingness to cooperate with the inspectors. I can imagine a resolution that avoids altogether any mention of the use of force. The whole U.S. intervention in Afghanistan was never addressed in any of the Security Council resolutions explicitly. The Security Council had a lot of resolutions about Afghanistan, but it never talked about the U.S. use of force. Earlier resolutions about counterterrorism seemed to just open up a green light in that area, and the Council just looked the other way. So this would, I think, be another time where the Council was divided. It doesn't want to be irrelevant. It doesn't want to vote against the U.S., but on the other hand, it simply sidesteps it.
Go ahead,
George. Can I complicate this?
Yes, please.
I agree with the analysis. I think that's a pretty good prediction of what's going to happen, and which, of course, gets France off the hook, so it doesn't have to veto its oldest allies. I mean, let's not forget, the U.S. has been, the French have been the U.S. ally since the Battle of Yorktown in 1791. But having said that, let's look at the difficulties. I think the United States, even though it can and will evade a war resolution, has to kind of make a pretty convincing case before the Council by displaying lots of exhibits A, B, C, D, X that Saddam is in breach, that he needs to be disarmed, hasn't disarmed. Unless the United States manages to do that, the war to come will lack some legitimacy, I would say. And to add to the problem, you might argue that Blix, the chief inspector, is kind of implicitly in cahoots with the French and the Germans, in the sense that as he doesn't turn up stuff, which is hard to do in a country which is as vast as Iraq, he will press for a delaying tactic, which of course means no war as the summer comes in. So what I'm saying is that the burden of proof, literally, is now in the United States. Mr. Negroponte will have to go before the Council with a whole bagful of evidence which will turn the tide in favor of the United States and against the French and the Germans, and by the way, the Chinese and the Russians, which are not as noisy in the opposition, but are mumbling, making sounds that sound like no.
Okay, restrain your emails. We know the Battle of Saratoga was in 1781, but we're going to continue.
What did I say? Oh, 91, sorry.
That's all
81,
right.
81, sorry.
We're talking about the United Nations Security Council in 2003. We'll take your calls after a break. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the endgame inside the United Nations Security Council and the high stakes of international diplomacy as the next deadline on Iraq approaches, that on Monday. Our guests are Edward Luck, Director of the Center on International Organizations at Columbia University, and Joseph Jaffe, the editor of Die Zeit, a German weekly newspaper. To get in on our conversation, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Betty, who's with us from Amagansett in New York.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I strongly disagree with the speaker's earlier view that the reason for France and Germany's opposition to the United States' drive for war is because they, France and Germany, lack the military power of the United States, that they are vying for power with the United States. As if they are not, that they have no right to be truly opposed to the use of force as opposed to the use of diplomacy, and that the implication that Blix is somehow in cahoots, I think was the word one of the speakers used, with France and Germany to cause a delay in the process by giving the inspectors more time. It seems to me that the attitude coming primarily from speakers in this country, in the United States, that somehow Europe is irrelevant, and that word has been used over and over again, and by members of the president's own cabinet, I believe, that Europe is irrelevant and that its opinions are irrelevant solely because they lack the same type of huge military power that the United States does. I find it really embarrassing to be an American and to hear that kind of arrogance displayed in our cause, so to speak.
Joseph Jaffe, I think she was talking about some of your analysis there.
Well, I didn't say that Europeans are irrelevant. What is true is that they lack the kind of clout, the kind of projection capabilities that the United States has, and that they would have, certainly the Germans, hardly have any of the wherewithal to go into that war. I would actually disagree with that adjective irrelevant. The Europeans are strategically, militarily irrelevant because they simply cannot fight the kind of war the United States can fight now. I mean, the United States militarily is in a different kind of orbit. But in terms of politics, the Europeans and all the others aren't irrelevant because this war, which is not a war of defense, which is not a war to liberate Kuwait, does require a certain kind of legitimacy. This is a war of order rather than defense. And so legitimacy does make a difference even at home. I mean, even for Americans at home who are, currently supporting the war to 70%, it makes a difference, even for the home audience, whether the world somehow accepts the American cause as just or whether the United States is going ahead by itself with the British without this kind of mantle of legitimacy that this operation seems to require.
The point I was trying to make is that military might does not assure legitimacy. And
but I'm making the same point.
Could I comment on this?
Why don't you go ahead?
I think it's important to remember that when the UN was created in 1945, Chapter 7, which talks about the use of coercive methods to compel aggressors and others to listen to the council's edicts, really was central to the conception. The idea that you could have a group of countries working together to maintain international peace and security, part through mediation and fact-finding and good offices and all kinds of peaceful ways, but also through coercion, whether through economic sanctions or the use of military force. And what we have now is a situation where countries that ought to be capable of contributing to that joint use of military force have decided basically to opt out. And it's understandable that they have social agendas, they have domestic agendas that are very important, and we do as well. But it seems to me it's important for these countries, if they want to be part of military decision-making and part of military action internationally, which sometimes push comes to shove, sometimes it has to be used, that they have to make a greater effort to be part of that. And I think, you know, France and Germany have every right to speak their minds in the Council for whatever reasons, whether it's domestic politics or international law or whatever. But the question here really is the politics of the Council versus the legality of what the U.S. might or might not do. And I would argue that the U.S. has a legal case already to go forward under previous Security Council resolution. And we're really talking about here are politics and what's the best way to do international politics, what's the best way to appeal to domestic politics here as well. And no doubt the American people would be a lot more comfortable if we had a U.N. blessing. But on the other hand, I don't think it's a legal prerequisite. I think it's a political advantage.
Well, I strongly disagree with you on that. And I believe that the Europeans have every right to express their dissatisfaction with the use of force
Betty,
as a method of resolving this arms this inspection and arms and Iraqi situation.
Betty, thanks very much for the
call. Thank you.
Joining us now from her office here in Washington is Ruth Wedgwood. She's a professor of international law and diplomacy at Johns Hopkins University, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Is this a defining moment for the Security Council?
Well, I think it is a defining moment for Europe, and that I agree with Ed and Joe, in the sense that the Council contemplates that there will be the P5, the permanent five, Russia, China, U.S., France, and Britain, working together, and that there'll be a major sense of commitment to the center in, through that architecture. And the problem at the moment is that Europe is very busy defining itself. And one hears phrases in France about the civilianization of Europe, the Scandinavianization of Europe, the neutrality of Europe. I just came back from Berlin, and they went did a green-red debate in one of the old theaters, and there was a palpable mood of pacifism. So Europe at the moment, since they no longer feel under direct threat, are really stepping back. And that's going to bust up the premise of the Security Council, which is that the European members will be committed to global action.
If as President Bush warned in that speech that he gave on September 12th, if the UN Security Council fails to act to enforce its own resolutions, he would regard the United Nations as being, or the Security Council rather, as being irrelevant. Are those truly the stakes?
That's the same kind of warning that the Secretary General, Kofi Annan, delivered after Kosovo in 1999 and said that the Security Council is on paper, under the charter, the primary organ of authorizing the use of force. But if the Council doesn't rise to its responsibilities, that of course it will be disregarded, and that the UN Charter has both purposes, substantive purposes, that have to be fulfilled, as well as procedures.
Joseph Jaffe, you wanted to get in?
Well, yes, I want to respond to the caller, Betty, before, who was looking at this thing only in terms of right and would like to downplay or even ignore the issue of might. This reminds me of that old series, The Untouchables, where the Al Capone character said, "You get a lot farther with a kind word and a gun in your hand than with a kind word alone." And this is something that the French and the Germans, they are ignoring. They are ignoring the might aspect of this. It would never have come to this point with the inspectors being back after having been ignominiously thrown out in 98 unless the United States had A, taken the lead, and B, together with the British, fielded a massive military force which signaled to Saddam that this is for keeps, this is in earnest. Saddam would not have budged, would not have moved. So my point would be a philosophical here. You do sometimes in this nasty world need a kind of iron fist under your soft glove of diplomacy to get anywhere, especially with folks like Saddam Hussein.
Yeah. If I might add, I think one of the problems at the UN is that 45 years of Cold War where the UN really couldn't do enforcement measures. Just the soft side of the UN emerged, which is great, but there should supposed to be a hard side as well. And unfortunately, people don't seem to be ready for that, or they don't expect that from the UN.
Here's an email question I wanted to put to you from Martin in San Francisco. Outside of creating the perception of consensus for sovereign U.S. action, what value does the administration and the Republican leadership see in the modern UN? Ruth Wedgwood?
Well, if you can get countries to sign on, it often helps you a great deal financially. We got $36 billion to help pay for the original Gulf War in 91. The Japanese and the Germans find it easier to engage in these kinds of coalition alliances if the UN has voted in favor because of their own history and the concerns of their neighbors. So if you can get a council resolution, that's great. I think it's important that we're simply putting the conversation in terms of the charter, whether or not we have different theories of how you read it. But money counts. The international law is taken seriously by a great many countries, and it's important that we frame our actions in an account of the law.
Ruth Wedgwood, appreciate your taking time to speak with us today.
Thank you.
Ruth Wedgwood is a professor of international law and diplomacy at Johns Hopkins University and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. She joined us on the phone from her office in Washington. Let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is Doug, who's with us from Porter, Maine.
Yes, hi. My question is, I'm wondering if there's a paradox here that if the United States exercises its superior military economic might too vigorously, too often, that it might actually in the long run reduce our power and influence by creating enough resentment both in foreign governments and particularly of smaller countries and in populations that we may risk losing the support we need, say, for fighting terrorism. I know that for a lot of small countries, the UN is their place, almost their only place, to really be noticed and recognized.
Joseph Jaffe, certainly if the United States continues to act by itself, the perceptions of arrogance in Europe will not decrease.
Absolutely not. The problem, the underlying problem that the United States is facing these days, which means after the demise or self-dissolution of the Soviet Union, that its power is no longer constrained by a worthy rival. That's getting everybody nervous, the Europeans and, of course, the Russians and the Chinese and the small powers. This is something that comes with the territory. If you are number one, if you have more power, more usable power than any previous nation since Rome, others will suspect its holder. What is he going to do with this? Is he going to go after us next? So my sense here is that on the one hand, somebody has to lead these 200 odd or almost 200 nations in the world. Otherwise nothing will happen, as it didn't happen in the Kosovo and against Slobodan Milosevic. On the other hand, one of the great assets of power is trust. The more you have, the more you have to try to gain the trust of others, the lesser nations, so that they won't gang up on you, as Doug has just kind of implied. Trust in your own power, the bigger it is, trust is also an asset for the United States. And I think that though George W. has worked very hard to overcome his initial isolationist reflexes in the first year by, for instance, working very patiently within the UN for a resolution, that sticks in the craw of people the first year in his presidency. Well, he kind of acted as if he doesn't give a damn about what the others think. This has been replaced by a more multilateralist phase, but the United States is clearly stuck in a dilemma here. Somebody's got to lead, somebody's got to have the wherewithal, but if you want others to keep others from ganging up against you, your power has to come with a kind of trust that makes others believe that this great unbridled power is used to the benefit of all.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a question now from Phil, who's on the line in Burlingame, California.
Hi, great show.
Thank you.
You know, Europe doesn't have a very good track record on the application of force. Germany recognized Yugoslavia, which led to the breakup and the problems with Bosnia-Herzegovina. Belgium and Europe pulled out of, you know, Rwanda and the genocide there. France is having all its problems with Algeria. I think the issue here is that, you know, the Europeans, when they've applied force, it's often been for colonial reasons. And here we've got a bully in the form of Iraq. The United States is just trying to get the bully to stay within his boundaries and not massacre his people. So the senior Bush initiated this great idea that since there's a single world power, we'll get everybody to vote when we get to use the power. But, you know, because the Europeans don't belly up to it doesn't mean that they won't be happy if the U.S. goes in, cleans up Iraq, and it no longer threatens regional stability. So the question in this is, everybody's concerned about, you know, what Europe thinks, but except for England and a handful of other countries, I don't see them being constructive. What do they propose to do with Iraq? If all they're going to do is say the U.S. shouldn't do anything, well, how do they propose to deal with him firing on Allied forces 10 to 20 times a week, developing chemical weapons, suppressing his own people? You know, what is the solution? Forget about what the problem is. What's the solution then?
Edward Luck, is there any indication of what the French or German or the French-German position would envision in Iraq 6 months or a year hence?
Well, I think Doug and Phil ought to have a good debate of their own. They're both very articulate and make good points. I think basically...
Get them on the radio.
That's right. And the image we have is that France and Germany basically want to postpone what may be the inevitable, that they hope something would break in the meantime. Because they recognize that if it comes to the use of military force, they're going to have a very small role. But I do recall that at the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, there was a lot of very negative talk, including from many of our allies, particularly about the U.S. bombing. And then when it got over relatively quickly, when the troops were very much welcomed into Kabul, that turned around quite quickly. And I think the same thing could happen here. If, in fact, the war is quick, if, in fact, the troops are welcomed, I think you'll see the French and the Germans and everyone else saying, well, yes, this is great. I don't think they've cut off all their options here. I think they're trying to play a bit both sides of the fence, depending on how it goes. But I think Phil's question is right. I don't think the Europeans have given us a good alternative. If they say the inspectors haven't found anything, therefore we should have more inspections, you know, there is some credibility as in terms of the inspections themselves, whether they, in fact, are going to be effective. I would have more sympathy for their position if, in fact, there seemed to be a lot of momentum in the inspections, and if, in fact, they seem to be close to getting the smoking gun, if, in fact, they seem to be forcing Saddam to disarm. But so far, I haven't seen that, and so I think they're case is very much weakened.
After this break, we'll wrap up our conversation about the United Nations Security Council and turn our attention to a case of friendly fire and the threat that friendly fire might pose in the event of war in Iraq. And by the way, Scott Stürmer sent us an email, and that's to correct my correction. He notes that the Battle of Saratoga wasn't in 1781 either. It was in 1777. My fault. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Right now, we're wrapping up our conversation about the United Nations Security Council and the upcoming deadline, Mondays, on Iraq. Edward Luck is with us from the Center on International Organizations, and Joseph Jaffe, the editor of Die Zeit, a German weekly newspaper. Let's go now to Angie, who's on the line from Göttingen, Germany.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for your show. It's really great.
Oh, thank you.
Listening to it. I've got two questions for your guest. I think that there is a lot of political naivete in Europe, and I wonder whether it's due that the present generation in power has had a very comfortable life, in fact, during the past 50, 60 years. And the second question would be whether the present quarrel about how to deal with Iraq doesn't show that the UN maybe is something like a toothless tiger and in need of a reform itself. Well, these are the two questions. I take the answers off the air.
Angie, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Joseph Jaffe, I guess we'll give the first part of that question to you.
Okay. I'll pick up on both Phil before the break and Angie. The problem of the Europeans, the Germans and the French, is that they have no answer to the question posed by Phil. What would you do? How would you deal and do away with the mortal problems caused by somebody like Saddam Hussein, who has a long record of malfeasance? Apart from their current strategy, which says delay, forestall, and ultimately stop the war, what I haven't heard from my European compatriots is, all right, if you want to rule out war, if you want to rule out force, what are you prepared to do? How are you going to constrain? How are you going to disarm Saddam? And the logic of the European position really is that we have to keep this control regime in place forever and ever, because, and now I'm going to pick up a word by Angie, the word of naivete, it is naive to believe that once those inspectors are gone again, that Saddam will use his resource only to make baby food and insecticides and artificial fertilizer. And that's where the European position is analytically, strategically, and politically a very weak one.
And Edward Luck, why don't you pick up on Angie's second question, and then about is the UN toothless? Is it in need of reform?
It may be toothless, but it's probably not a tiger. It is an organization that's quite good at what one might call soft power. It's good at dealing with the cleanup of the use of military force. I recall after the last Gulf War, the UN was very important in terms of the authorization of force and in part getting Congress on board and getting an international coalition put together. That political support was very important. During the fighting, the UN was nowhere to be seen. It was just left out by the US and others. But as soon as the fighting was over, immediately the whole terms of the post-conflict situation in Iraq were determined through a UN Security Council resolution, which is one which I think still gives the U.S. and others the legal support for, in fact, acting in Iraq. The UN, I think, is also very important in the creation and dissemination of international legal norms, including all of those that Iraq is violating. It's not just a question of Security Council resolutions. The International Atomic Energy Agency is a UN agency that does inspections on nuclear weapons. The UN also has been in the centerpiece of getting conventions on biological and advances on the chemical weapons front as well. So I think the UN is important in being a forum for countries to try to find common ground, and when they do, to help point the way. But there are times when the organization is just divided. And when it's divided, it's probably useful to know that countries aren't all aboard, and I guess it tells us in that sense as a barometer, but then it really can't do very much. And this is, I'm afraid, one of those cases. But when the fighting stops, I'll give you 10-1, the UN would be front and center, and I think the French and Germans would be among the countries clamoring to be part of the post-war cleanup because of all the potential wealth coming out of Iraq.
Joseph Jaffe, one final quick question, and that is the risks to the United States in bypassing the Security Council, if that's what it comes to. How can the United States, if it ignores the Security Council on Iraq, then turn around and employ it in the case of North Korea?
Very good question, especially since once the Iraq war is over, the United States surely will turn to the North Korean regime. Well, the best answer I have is this. That's a new game, and even America's most vociferous critics in this current Iraq game know that without the United States, the UN is truly toothless. And they also know that the Kim Il-jong regime is truly dangerous. They may have nuclear weapons already. They certainly will have nuclear weapons, and much closer to nuclear weapons than Saddam is or has ever been. And so my hunch or my bet is that the others will once more turn to the United States to take care of that problem. But I also agree, finally, with Ed, that the others, certainly the French, the Germans, I don't know, but the French will certainly go along, if only, to be at the table when the spoils of war will be distributed, and so will others. By the way, for your reader, for your listeners, the picture in Europe is quite complex. It's not just the Brits who are on the side of the United States. It also happens that the Spaniards and the Italians and even the great or small Danes are in this one on the American side, so all is not lost.
Well, I think you can add a lot of Eastern European states in addition.
Well, yes, and the Eastern Europeans, of course.
Well, Joseph Jaffe, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Joseph Jaffe is editor of Die Zeit, and he spoke with us on the line from his office in Hamburg. And Edward Luck, appreciate your coming in today.
Thanks very much.
Edward Luck is director of the Center on International Organization at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University, also the author of Mixed Messages, American Politics and International Organization.